statements reported during this program.
Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power. Now here's your host, Ward Morrow.
Today we'll be joined by I Am a Teamster author Terry Spencer Hesser, Economic Policy Institute economist Heidi Sherholtz, and Center for American Progress Director of Government Reform Reese Rushing. Welcome to Inside Government, Terry.
Thank you.
So you've written a book called I Am a Teamster about Regina Polk. Tell us a little about that.
I wrote the book because the Polk Foundation hired me, basically, to do this biography about Regina. I met her briefly once. She was one of the first female Teamster union organizers who was killed in a plane crash in 1983. I didn't know her, and I was kind of interested to research the story because I love the whole idea that she was somebody who was so wealthy and certainly did not need to walk picket lines or drive around with an ice pick in her glove compartment. And so I was just trying to figure out who this person was, really.
And what was her background?
She grew up extremely poor. Poor. Her parents were farmers. Her father was a farmer. They lived all over Arizona. And then she ended up getting into Mills College, and I think that sort of changed her life because it was her first exposure to extreme wealth and then the extreme inequities. And then she ended up in Chicago working as a waitress or a hostess at the Red Star Inn, which was this kind of iconic restaurant off, you know, one of our major artery expressways. And she didn't like the way the wait staff was being treated. So she ended up calling a lot of different unions, not just Local 743, but a lot of unions who didn't even want to bother organizing something so small. But she called so many times and made herself such a nuisance that they finally gave her the cards. And she did end up organizing that restaurant and got fired for it. But then she was hired by the union. So it was auspicious.
And Chicago seems to be a very interesting town to me. I mean, one of my heroes has been Studs Terkel, and you know, he always interviewed kind of unique characters. Was she sort of a Chicago character?
I don't think we can claim her as a Chicago character because she didn't grow up here, and yet I completely agree with you, and I feel the same way about Studs Terkel. And I personally grew up in what I like to think of as the most politically incorrect town in America, Cicero, Illinois. It's just west of Chicago, and the town is famous for welcoming Al Capone and threatening to murder Martin Luther King. So, yeah, the same kinds of characters that Regina found in her union were the kinds of characters that I watched growing up.
So what kind of role did she serve with the Teamsters? I mean, I guess this was in the 70s when she first got her start?
Well, she started as an organizer, and then she became a business agent. But I think she had a really quick career trajectory. I mean, she did sort of live for it. And I think she didn't exactly make herself popular within or without the union. I mean, the interesting thing about her is I don't think anything was a popularity contest for her. I think it was all about the end. And basically, I think she... It's weird when you say I think she cared more than most people do about other people, because even when I started researching this and I'm thinking, did she really? Where's the flaw here? Where's the fault here? But I think she did.
Talk a little about, you know, her first getting involved with the union. And when you were talking about Red Star, what were some of the working conditions or the problems there?
It was really just that the people were sort of hired and fired willy-nilly, that it was a lot of people who were just treated poorly, the cooks, the wait staff, the sous chefs, the whatever. And so they would be basically subjected to any kind of verbal abuse and fired, you know, sort of on a whim and replaced quickly on a whim.
And did she find that it was easy to organize?
I don't know that she found that it was easy, but she was completely committed. She didn't really ever think about herself. I mean, the organizing stories that I love that people told me is that when they organized the university, she would set up at the University of Chicago. They were doing the hospital. And she would just basically put a sort of little mini tent umbrella on the campus and people would stop by, and she talked to them, and when what she said to them is, I'm going to be here for you. I mean, maybe in the past you wouldn't have had this experience or you wouldn't have it with somebody else, but I'll be here for you. And she was. And so all these years later, as I'm interviewing these women, they all said she was there. I mean, when arbitration came along, she didn't shirk it. She didn't walk out the back. She didn't avoid it in any way.
And why do you believe that this was important to her?
Okay, that's a really good question. So it's a two-part answer. One is, I'd like to believe, and I think I do believe, that she really was somebody who cared so deeply about other people, possibly because it's for the good, because, you know, some people are just drawn to the good like other people are drawn to the dark side. And then the second half of that answer is, she had such a lovely, cushy life that I wonder, after growing up poor, whether she didn't feel a little bit guilty about that. And the quote that pretty much everybody said is, Gina wanted everyone to have as much as she had. And since she had a very nice life, that would have been really hard for, you know, 99.9% of the population.
And how was her life cushy in the way that you say it?
She was married to the chairman of a bank. They had, as some of the other organizers told me in the book, she would order just pizzas for us or whatever, or, you know, for any meeting that would cost us. It was basically our day rate. I mean, what we made every day was what she sort of, you know, gladly spent on us in an hour.
And, you know, the time that she was involved in doing this, I mean, things were changing, so she kind of came in at an interesting time. But, you know, women were not a large part of organized labor at that point. Minorities were still sort of breaking their glass ceiling functionally. Tell us some of the things that happened to her along that way. What were some of the influences she had?
Well, I think when she walked into this union, she didn't realize what a Neanderthal place that it would turn out to be. I mean, this was extremely sexist, extremely racist, and that was just normal Chicago everyday business in the 70s. It was probably even worse. It was probably worse than most places. But she somehow had to navigate the other women being jealous of her for being aggressive and educated and promotable. The men treating her like a babe, basically, and somehow the fact that she navigated that and made it work for her is admirable to me.
And she sort of went in a different direction in terms of organizing. She was going after more white-collar workers and women in particular, is that right?
I think she was really mostly concerned with the plight of women, and women loved her, even though she was... there's pictures in the book. I think very beautiful. In fact, I was even trying to figure out what actress would play her in a movie. I think she was very concerned. I think she was primarily a feminist and really concerned with what's going to happen to women if this happens. And women trusted her.
And did that lead her at some point? I know a big part of your book is talking about the Teamsters' resolution on women workers.
Yeah, I think that's probably 6 months before the end of her life. They closed a lot of factories in Chicago, in Cicero, in whatever, and all of these women were basically, they were out of work, but they were out of work and so uneducated that they couldn't read the postings that they were out of work, so they would still show up at these factories and just wait in line to get in the morning until someone told them to go home that they were never coming in. So she started these retraining programs, and then she was assigned by the governor of the state of Illinois to head this kind of task force, and that's when she got on the plane, and it was a plane crash, and she died.
Now, I know in your book you talked about how when she was first getting started, the local was kind of factionalized. There was sort of an Irish mafia, and there was an African-American faction.
Yeah.
And how does she navigate between all that?
I'm going by people that I've interviewed, so I'm trying to not editorialize too much. But my feeling is that the sort of African-American segment this guy. He was funny. He had such a reputation as this, you know, tough guy, blah, 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 friends with Jesse Jackson. And by the time I went to interview him, he was, you know, taking care of his grandson. And so sweet that the story seemed incongruous to me, but kind of tough and threatening. And, you know, I mean, I think that union sort of harkened back almost to the, what they would say, the good old days. So I think the African American side was hard for her. I think the women from that end were hard for her, and I'm sure she came in looking, you know, very like lily white and educated. And yet, Don Simpson was the first one to say, I couldn't ignore her. I mean, she came in and she came and she came and she came and she came, and she was really committed. So I think her commitment eventually won over that side. The other side, Tom Hamilton was her mentor. I mean, he basically took her under his wing and showed her the ropes.
And did you ever get any stories or reports that she felt like her life was in danger at any point?
No. Mm-mm, never.
Because you kind of mentioned, you know, having a pick in the glove compartment.
Yeah. I never heard that she felt that her life was in danger. But she was, I think she saw herself as some sort of superhero girl. Yeah. Someone told me that he felt that some of the things, you know, the altercations or the arguments, you know, after a settlement or whatever, was, you know, partly posturing and partly theatrical, and maybe that was true, but I don't think she would have hesitated from using the ice pick.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Attention AFGE members, government and military employees, looking for a hassle-free way to buy a new computer, electronics, or home appliances? Purchasing Power allows you to get items such as Dell laptops, HP desktops, and Kenmore appliances through easy payroll deduction. Purchase any laptop from July 15th through August 15th and receive a free custom skin. Get started today. Log on to shoppurchasingpower.com. That's shoppurchasingpower.com.
AFGE members are eligible for a 6% members only discount.
Have you been to AFGE's new online store? Members and activists can now purchase AFGE items online using a credit card and have them conveniently shipped right to your door. Visit the store at www.afgestore.org. You'll be able to buy all the hottest AFGE products, from hats and watches to coffee mugs and pens, plus the famous Inside Government t-shirts. That's more than 70 items to choose from. Start shopping today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We're continuing with Terry Spencer Hesser, author of I Am a Teamster, a story about Regina Polk, who was an organizer out in Chicago. And we were talking about the different factions she worked with, and we were talking about women that seemed to trust her. Tell us a little about why people felt like Regina earned their trust.
I think a couple of things. I think she was a very straight talker. And I think she backed up what she said she would do. And I think she was also so kind and supportive. It's like, okay, on the one hand, she's a very committed, you know, labor person. On the other hand, she's this beautiful woman wearing, you know, Elizabeth Arden and giving away her amazing clothes to all of these women, saying, oh, here, this will look better on you than it does on me, or even her passion for animals. I think somebody like her would be somebody that anyone would naturally trust.
But do you think it was hard? I know when I first got started in the labor movement as a young person, sometimes, you know, that can seem threatening to established leadership, that sort of thing. How did she work with established leaders? How did she earn their trust?
I actually think it got more difficult. In the beginning, she probably earned their trust, if trust is the right word, by being a hard worker and extremely committed. But I think later, as time went on, and she felt like maybe the union could be doing more, could be going here, you know, had certain disagreements, I think it got harder.
You mentioned in your book that you actually met her at one point, and you mentioned that earlier. What was your impression of her?
I just couldn't believe it. I mean, I'd heard about her because, you know, I live in Chicago. So I'd heard all of the lore of Regina Polk and the whole Teamster thing. And when I met her, she looked like a character in a movie. She looked like Meryl Streep playing Regina Polk or something. I mean, a cape, a hat, a this, very dramatic, very well done. And, you know, I already mentioned I grew up in Cicero. I'm looking for the beer belly and the crowbar.
And was that sort of how most of the labor leaders in Chicago appeared at that time? Was that sort of the stereotype?
At that time, yes.
So did you find that within the labor movement, I mean, was she highly unusual? I mean, was she really...
Highly unusual. I mean, an educated feminist woman in the Teamsters Union at that time was highly unusual. That's like...
A lot of heavy male influence in the labor movement. And she was successful in organizing just women, or did you also find she was successful in reaching out and organizing men as well?
Oh, no. I mean, she was successful in her campaigns were primarily white-collar female workers. And so I think it was primarily women that she was helping, but it was primarily men that she had to work with in order to do that. And I think, you know, it's interesting. All these years after her death, people during interviews still started to cry. And men started to cry. And it was kind of shocking at first. It was like, wait, this is so long ago. My parents died then, and I wouldn't be able to summon tears in an interview. And yet more than one person was just teary talking about what she did for them and her devotion.
And give us a flavor of that. What were some of the things these people brought out? What were some of their stories?
There was a woman at the University of Chicago who was, it was after the union was in, this woman started showing up for work late, and it was a big problem. The thing is, she had been raped the weekend before, and she sort of flipped out, and she quit. And so the union couldn't really stand behind her because she quit. They didn't fire her. She quit. She just walked out. And then after she went for counseling and eventually went to the hospital and did whatever she did, she wanted her job back. And they basically said, well, this is out of our purview. And Regina thought, no, it's not. And so basically took up her cause, went wouldn't drop it. Everybody from human resources to the president of the school, and had this woman's job reinstated.
And any others that really stand out in your mind, some other stories that people told you?
Yeah, there was some of the women standing online they didn't even speak English. They didn't even really know who she was when she started teaching them, organizing these classes and finding a place. And at that time she was, I mean, the last year of her life was really sad and dramatic because first she had a miscarriage, so she lost her baby, and then she lost her life. So basically her husband lost both of them in the same year. But even at that time, his complaint is she just didn't take a break. I mean, she didn't stop working. She was there she was doing the union stuff during the day and the training stuff at night because she just wanted to make sure that everything was going as it should have.
And I'm trying to envision, you know, you mentioned in the book that she liked to wear hats. That was one of her things she was known for. And I'm just trying to imagine her going into managers' offices wearing her hat, presenting the union grievance in Chicago in the 1970s. Were there any interesting stories about that?
I think she played and dressed for her audience. I think when she was, you know, doing something with certain union bosses, it was a complete dress down. I think when it was an arbitration or it had something, you know, something with after effect, then she would be the most well-dressed, intimidating person in the room. So I think she was into costuming in a big way.
And eventually she moved into a staff position with the Teamsters, is that right?
Yeah, kind of quickly after she was fired from the Red Star Inn.
And what was her role? What did she do?
Initially organizer, and then later business agent.
And I read in the book, I mean, you talk about that she was really motivated and inspired to a large extent by Jimmy Hoffa. Tell me a little more about that.
I love that. I think she romanticized the sort of tough guy labor thing. This isn't about lawyers and arbitration. This is about settling it here and now, going toe-to-toe with somebody else, basically. And so before she would go in to make a speech or before she'd go in to make any kind of a big presentation, she'd listen to his speeches over and over and over again to kind of absorb the strength of his cadence.
And, I mean, he was obviously a very different kind of leader, it sounds like, than she was.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
How did she incorporate, you know, I guess, different things in other than just coming in and speaking? I mean, did she reach out to some of the older types in the Teamsters and, you know, the folks that had been there for a long time maybe and had a different way of looking at things?
Not from what I found. I don't know that wouldn't be true, but I don't have any examples of that.
And did she ever meet Jimmy Hoffa?
No, never. And they were born on the same day. Their birthday is both Valentine's Day.
And I know at one point in the book you talk about before she gave a speech, she actually listened to a recording or made a recording of him?
Yeah, no, listened to recordings that she had of him giving speeches. Particularly, she gave a long speech about contracts, and so she listened to his speech before that. And part of the speech is in the book, and basically what she's saying is, your contract is all you've got, so don't let this slide. This is the only agreement that matters.
And did she do a lot of contract negotiations? Was that her specialty?
At the end, no, not so much in the beginning, but at the end. And it's the lawyer that worked for her local was saying that it was she was kind of amazing in that she could learn the intricacies of contracts so quickly, so well.
And how long did she work at the Teamsters? She died fairly young, correct?
Yeah, she was, she died in 80. Oh, my God. You're asking me to do math. 30? 30? I'm trying to remember how old she would have been. 33.
Yeah, so it wasn't a really long career. How did she die?
She was killed in an Air Illinois plane crash on her way to Springfield. The governor had appointed her to this, you know, task force for re-educating all of these women that had lost their jobs in these factories when the factories closed. And so she was going to Springfield for a meeting.
And yet her legacy lives on not just in your book, but in some other accomplishments as well. Tell us a little about the scholarship fund.
The Regina Polk Foundation was, first of all, when she died, her husband, her estate, sued Air Illinois, and they got the largest settlement for any woman of childbearing age, basically. And so her husband is a funds management guy, and so he'd been investing it, and he put together a board, and they used the proceeds from this to give scholarships to kids that are interested in labor. There's an annual conference every year of people interested in labor, people working in labor, and, you know, a variety of speakers. It's over a weekend once a year.
And if people wanted to make a donation or wanted to find out about the scholarships, is there a website or anything?
You know what? I don't think there's a website, but I know you can go online. It's the Regina Polk Foundation.
And let's talk a little about, they give scholarships for labor studies at college, high schools?
Labor studies at college, but also they have a high school program. It was interesting because they were just talking about the difficulties in organizing in a high school. And the story that I heard back from one of the girls was, essentially, she took the Regina approach. It was, well, wait a minute, why do you just keep talking? It's just a matter of getting those cards signed, right? So, kind of cute.
And is there any special emphasis on getting women involved in the labor movement through the fund?
It's primarily women.
You mentioned something about a conference. Is there an annual conference?
There is an annual conference, usually in the Chicago suburbs in August or September every year. Although I don't know when this year's is, but it must be coming up.
Okay, we're going to pause for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Attention AFGE members.
Did you know about AFGE's new service to assist you with legal rights issues? It's called the AFGE Legal Rights Attorney Program, which offers free attorney representation in cases brought by AFGE councils and locals on behalf of AFGE members. The program, administered by AFGE's General Counsel's Office, has handled more than 150 cases since 2005 and has won millions of dollars in back pay for our members. The Legal Rights Attorney Program is designed to take cases that will be brought to arbitration, the Merit System Protection Board, or other review boards where both back pay and attorney's fees are available. These cases include removal, suspension, reduction in pay, reduction in grade, and furlough. For information about the program, please email legalrights@afge.org. Not a member? Become one and take advantage of this incredible resource today.
Have you been to AFGE's new online store? Members and activists can now purchase AFGE items online using a credit card and have them conveniently shipped right to your door. Visit the store at www.afgestore.org. You'll be able to buy all the hottest AFGE products, from hats and watches to coffee mugs and pens, plus the famous Inside Government t-shirts. That's more than 70 items to choose from. Start shopping today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Heidi Shierholz, the economist from the Economic Policy Institute. Welcome back to Inside Government.
Thanks for having me.
So let's talk a little about job creation these days. Doesn't seem to be going very well. It's a top priority, big issue in the election. Tell us about it.
Yeah, the issue in the labor market is, well, the good news first is that we are no longer losing jobs. You know, a year ago we were losing hundreds of thousands of jobs a month. That's not happening anymore. But the pace of job gains is so slow that it doesn't have any chance of actually moving the dial on unemployment. It's not going to put the backlog of unemployed workers that we have in this country back to work. We need to do more. The issue is that the scope of the actions that are being taken is just not does not match the scale of the problem.
And I'm thinking in terms of like the census, a lot of money was spent on that. A lot of folks are going to be let go from doing that work. Is that going to have an impact in the short term?
In some ways, much of the impact has come and gone. So in May, the census had over 500,000 workers on its payroll, but they've mostly been let go. Right now, there's around 200,000 workers, temporary workers still on the census payroll who will be let go in the next couple of months. So we will continue to see those dings to employment, but a lot of that has already come and gone. That census, they're pretty efficient over there. They get that done pretty quickly. In a couple of months, they hire 500,000 people, and then it's over.
Well, what are we going to need to do to create some more jobs? I mean, obviously, that's where we have to be headed.
That's right, and it's pretty clear. So here's the broad brushstrokes. Usually during a recession, a government has two main tools in their toolkit, monetary policy and fiscal policy. So monetary policy is essentially governments reduce interest rates in order to stimulate businesses to invest and to get things going, and then that will lead to hiring. The problem right now is that interest rates are near 0%. They can't cut them anymore. So that tool is essentially thrown out of our toolkit. It just doesn't have any power. We can't make negative interest rates. So the only thing left that can really move the dial on unemployment is fiscal policy. That means more spending to create jobs, something along the lines of the Recovery Act that we had a year ago in February. The slowing recovery just demonstrates further that that's absolutely what we need to be doing right now.
And that's pretty controversial. I mean, the taxed enough already. People feel like we spend too much money. There's a lot of discussion over that, the bailout for the police and firefighter and teachers bill.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if that was cut back, there's talks about the Department of Defense cutting back. I mean, if the government really starts, you know, buckling its belt and tightening up and cutting back, what's that going to do to the economy?
Yeah, that's exactly the wrong thing to be doing right now. And I'm actually very sympathetic to these concerns about the deficit, and also sympathetic to the extent that the concerns in many ways are really misplaced right now. So here's the deal with the deficit. The biggest by far contributor to the increase in the deficit over the last couple of years has been the recession itself. So when we enter a big recession like this, revenues fall as people lose jobs, so they're not paying as much in taxes, and businesses lose, profits go down, so they're not paying as much in taxes. So government revenues really take a hit. And then government spending on safety net things related to unemployment goes up. So Medicaid, food stamps, those kinds of things all increase. And so during a recession, the deficit goes way up. That's what we're seeing right now. The best way to bring the deficits down is actually to create jobs and get taxpayers, get business profits, so they're paying taxes, so we can get the economy going again. So I think one important fact to put this in context is that the entire Recovery Act added only 1 to 2% to our long-term fiscal gap. Our long-term budget problems, the Recovery Act likely increased that by only 1 or 2%. Our long-term budget problems have everything to do with rising health care costs, a temporary increase in spending right now to create jobs is will actually get us on the right track, can make us richer moving forward.
Now, when I'm talking to some of my relatives who are not economists, of course, neither am I, we're all sitting back going, well, over the past 2 years, I know we bailed out Wall Street, I know we bailed out the auto industry, all this seems to be private sector stuff we're bailing out. How do we get the private sector to actually start hiring again after we've done all these things?
Yeah, now that's a very important question. The thing is, the private sector will start hiring again when they see demand for their goods and services pick up, so that they need to hire new people to get the goods and services ready to go out the door. That's the bottom line. Private sector will start hiring when they see demand for their stuff increasing. So in order to get demand for their stuff to increase, we need people to get out there and invest and spend. The problem is consumers have really pulled back. They're feeling a lot poorer than they were before the recession started, because indeed they are a lot poorer than before the recession started. Housing prices have taken a big hit. The labor market is very weak, so families are facing job loss, stagnant wages. So people are really pulling back. We're in this situation where the government is really the spender of last resort to get out there, boost demand for stuff, boost demand for goods and services, so private sector businesses will really start hiring.
So, you know, when people talk about fiscal policy and whether, you know, would this be better if we gave another tax cut to the richest of the rich, who apparently are really having a hard time, unlike the rest of everyone else, or doing something to actually help the folks that have been hard hit spend the money like you're talking about, wouldn't that, if the folks at the bottom got a little benefit like the unemployment insurance, they'll spend that money and then it sort of trickles up? Are we back to trickle up economics?
Yeah, that's and this is very, very clear in the evidence that the propensity to spend that's the term economists use, but it just means how likely are you to spend extra money that you find in your pocket. People who are living paycheck to paycheck are the ones who are the most likely to have no choice but to spend any money they get on necessities in their local economy, on food, on rent, on school supplies for their kids this fall. So getting money in the hands of people who don't have very much of it is a very good kind of stimulus. So tax cuts for the rich, that's much less likely to inject money directly into the economy than getting money in the pockets of people who don't have very much. They're the ones who are the most likely to have no choice but to spend it, so it's going to go right into local economies.
Now, let's get into some demographics for a minute. What are the demographics of the jobless rate? Who's being the hardest hit?
Yeah, that's a good question. There's huge variation by demographic category. So broadly, men have gotten hit worse than women in this recession due primarily to their concentration in very cyclical industries like manufacturing and construction. Workers with less education have really felt the brunt of this recession. Their unemployment rates have gone up much higher than workers with, say, a college degree or more. The age impact has been very interesting with this recession. So young workers have gotten hit really, really hard in the job market. Their unemployed employment rate has gone very high. Say, you know, workers age 25 or less, their unemployment rate is sky high. Older workers have been more hit on the asset side. Those were the workers who were, just by the nature of where they are in their life cycle, more likely to have been in the position to have a house that just lost, you know, 60% of its value, to have a 401k plan that just lost a lot of value. So older workers are a little bit more sheltered in the labor market, but they just took an enormous hit to their retirement security. Young workers, on the other hand, are really getting slammed in the labor market.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking about if Social Security had been privatized, boy, the older workers really would have been hammered with that.
Yeah, and we see a lot of that with, it used to be when people had defined benefit plans in their, for their retirement plans, where you know, regardless of what was going on in the economy, this is how much you were going to get when you retired, versus now, if the stock market takes a big hit, you're going to feel that in your retirement. So when we reach a point like this, when people now have defined contribution plans that depend on where things are in the, with the stock market, when they take a big hit like this, they're unable to retire. And we're really seeing that en masse right now. Older workers are simply not retiring because their retirement security has just been decimated, and they actually can't afford it. And if Social Security had been privatized, we'd see that, you know, to the nth power right now.
Now, let's talk about some of the other places that have been really hard hit. Obviously, state and local government, with the housing bubble bursting, property taxes are down, so the state and local level in terms of bringing in money is down. What industries also have been hard hit? You mentioned building construction.
Yeah, right. So exactly. Construction is the one that has seen the biggest employment losses. We got into this through a $6 trillion housing bubble that was fueled by a lot of overbuilding. So construction is taking a big hit, and it's going to take a very long time for that to come back. Manufacturing has also taken a big hit. Manufacturing is one of those extremely cyclical industries. It goes up a lot when expansions are going on, and really takes a big hit when there's a recession. Interestingly enough, manufacturing is adding jobs every month now. We're seeing some big, you know, it's been one of the leaders out of the, as far as the meager job growth that we are seeing, a lot of it has come in manufacturing. So those are two of the really big cyclical industries. Some of the more sheltered industries are the most sheltered industry is health services. And you can think of it this way. While your interest in say, you know, buying a new car might really vary with your feelings of economic security and whether or not you have been able to hold on to your job and the number of hours you need, you might put off purchasing a new car. But if you have a heart attack, you're going to the hospital no matter what. It doesn't matter what's going on in the business cycle. So the health services are just is just a much less cyclical industry. So they've been much more sheltered from this downturn.
So as my personal economic advisor on policy here, tell us in the last minute or so we've got, what economic policies do we need to be doing? Do we need a new stimulus bill, the green jobs concept? What do we have to do to really get the economy back right now, policy-wise?
Yep, it's pretty straightforward. We need more spending to create jobs. And something that was similarly crafted to, like the Recovery Act we had a year ago last February would be a very good start. Something that includes expansion of safety net spending, more fiscal relief to states, more infrastructure spending. And why not start thinking very, very seriously about having the government put people directly to work, having a sort of baby WPA out there that where the government actually hires people, gets people back to work, and starts. It's time that we really start thinking seriously about experimenting with something like that too. Right now,
we're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Are you an AFGE member who loves the great outdoors? Then the AFGE Union Sportsmen's Alliance benefit is perfect for you. Whether it's fins, furs, or feathers that calls you, the Union Sportsmen's Alliance has you covered. This unique benefit is a community of hunters and fishermen who share the Union Brotherhood. That's right, an exclusive hunting and fishing club by and for Union members, retirees, and their families. Your $25 membership gets you money-saving discounts on great outdoor gear and services, a free MyTopo.com online mapping subscription, a one-year subscription to a top outdoor magazine, and a $25 gift certificate for Beretta field gear. You'll also receive a subscription to the Union Sportsman's Journal. To learn more about this exciting benefit, please visit the member benefits page at afge.org or call us at 877-872-2211. That's 877-872-2211. Join today.
Have you been to AFGE's new online store? Members and activists can now purchase AFGE items online using a credit card and have them conveniently shipped right to your door. Visit the store at www.afgestore.org. You'll be able to buy all the hottest AFGE products, from hats and watches to coffee mugs and pens, plus the famous Inside Government t-shirts. That's more than 70 items to choose from. Start shopping today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government on InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Reese Rushing, the Director of Government Reform, the Center for American Progress. Welcome to Inside Government.
Hi.
So tell me a little bit about the government reform efforts that the campaign's doing.
Well, the Center for American Progress has recently launched a project that we call Doing What Works. This project has three elements. First, we're trying to identify programs and approaches that don't work to redirect resources and funds to programs that do work. We're also trying to establish mechanisms for smarter decision-making using things like performance assessment, dashboards, open government. And we're also trying to make government more efficient through operations improvements. So things like IT, human resources, and procurement. So those are the three pillars of our project.
And when you talk about government programs that don't work, obviously if you're a government employee somewhere, what criteria are you looking at to decide what programs don't work?
Well, I think we need to set strong goals for ourselves, define our priorities so that we know what we're trying to accomplish, and then measure whether we're reaching those goals and measure whether the programs that we have in place are effectively achieving those goals. So it's going to vary, by agency for each specific issue. There's different measurement challenges that must be addressed. But I think the overarching point is that we want to have goals in place. We want to know what our priorities are, and then we want to measure ourselves every day to make sure that we are achieving those goals. And we have programs that aren't producing the results that we want, that we either reform them so that they do produce those results, or we shut them down and redirect those resources to efforts that are working better.
And have there been any programs that you've identified that you don't believe are working or that need to be shut down?
We took a specific look at the Department of Education and some of its programs. We released a report back in the spring. And, the department has taken a new flexible results-based approach. And we looked at the programs to see, what fit with this approach and what doesn't. And within the department, there are many of these little, small, kind of niche programs that don't fit the mission of closing student achievement gaps that is really at the heart of what the Department of Education is trying to accomplish now. And so we targeted those programs, and we said, you know, we should cut these programs, but we, you know, at the same time, we need to put more resources into the things that are working and that are serving our key priorities.
And what kinds of programs are you finding you need to shift some money to? I mean, I know for many, many years, commentators have said that government's supposed to be doing more with less, to the point that some people feel like we're doing less with less. Are there things where you're finding that we need to expand government?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's part of what we're trying to do as well. You know, we're interested in identifying those success stories, learning from experience, also experimenting and innovating, trying new things, and again, measuring those approaches and where we find something that's working, to then scale those approaches up and expand them to other areas, and not only within an agency, but trying to learn across government from agency to agency, so that we take the best ideas and then try to apply them across government.
And what are some of those areas you found that we need to expand?
Well, I mean, I think within each agency, within each part of government, in every issue that government deals with, you know, I think our idea is that you expand the things that are working, and so at the same time you may be cutting programs in education, you're also expanding other approaches. The same would be true with healthcare or energy. You know, in energy, we've taken a look at the tax expenditures that go to oil companies that don't serve the objective of, you know, clean energy, energy security, the priorities that the president has laid out, that the department has laid out. And so we say, well, let's cut these tax expenditures that are going to oil companies, and we can redirect that money to serve the purpose of cleaner energy, of energy security.
Have you come across any best practices as you've analyzed? I was taken a little bit by one of the presentations this morning where it compared private sector workers and public sector workers, and it seemed to indicate that public sector workers are clearly more mission-driven. I mean, there seems to be data now that verify that. Are there some best practices like insourcing more, which was the Obama administration's idea, that might work to make government more efficient as opposed to the contractor workforce we're dealing with now?
I think that's something that we intend to take a close look at as we go forward with this project. We know that more insourcing is happening, and you know, I think we see that as a good thing. And we got a little bit carried away with contracting everything out, and it kind of deteriorated the core abilities of our government agencies. But we also want to look at how do you do insourcing smartly in a way that works for the agency and that is also producing results. So this is something that the project is going to be taking a very close look at going forward in the coming months.
I know for many years the federal government had a way of training the workforce and then having people kind of through the merit system maybe come in as a clerk typist and work your way up to a GS-15. But a lot of that was training programs in-house. A lot of that was done in-house. And over the 30 years, there's been a movement away from that of just trying to hire more people, say, straight off the street that have the skills and not investing in training the workforce. Do you think that there may be some investments in training the workforce and going back to what worked previously?
Yeah, I think absolutely that we want to make sure that that the workforce has the training that it needs. The federal government needs a high-quality workforce, and part of that developing a high-quality workforce is providing that training. And also for the to providing the opportunities to advance and reward high-quality workers. You know, one thing that we've also looked at is the proliferation of political appointees across government agencies, and you know, I think that in some of these positions, the government would be better served to have civil servants in those positions. I mean, we already have a messy appointments process with long-term vacancies that deteriorates an agency's ability to get things done, because if you don't have leadership, then you don't know what your direction is, and so some of that is the good civil servants deserve to be rewarded, and they hit a ceiling because you have all these political appointments. And so I think our idea is let's reward good performance and certainly let's train our federal employees so that they become high quality workers in service of the American people.
Now, federal employees over the past 8 to 10 years really have been concerned a lot with the National Security Personnel System, NSPS. And that was, if somebody was going to do an analysis of bad practices, that almost seems like it would jump out at you. For federal employees who had to be subjected to that or have been listening and concerned about that for many years, do you think that we need to move away from that kind of a concept and move towards something where employees are really brought to the table early and the mission of the agency and what you're going to do is going to be talked about, like the partnership kind of concepts the Obama administration has been talking about?
I think absolutely that our federal employees are a tremendous resource that they are on the front lines, and we need to listen to them, and that leadership needs to listen to them. I think that we've had a problem of sort of one way communication. I'm going to tell you what to do, and the new thing, the new bells and whistles that political appointees can bring with them when they come to an agency. That sometimes distracts from core functions, and so we need to make sure that we have mechanisms in place that federal employees can communicate with leadership, that they can feel comfortable communicating with leadership, and that leadership is actually listening to them, hearing their concerns and actively working to address those concerns and incorporating that into their decisions.
Now, we're here today, and you're having a conference called Doing What Works. What kind of labor input have you had in the conference, and how many federal employees are here, if you know?
Well, on our advisory board, SEIU is represented on our advisory board. I don't know how many labor unions are here today, but there are a number that are represented. Certainly... labor unions are a key ally of the Center for American Progress. Federal employees unions we work very closely with, and as part of this project we're in communication with. The federal employees we absolutely see as essential part of doing what works.
And as we talk about that, it seems like a fairly simple concept, doing what works and figuring out, analyzing the data and looking through things and trying to then use those tools. But in some places I've seen where they've used like CityStat in Baltimore. I know one of the things they looked at and saw was you could see one particular Saturday, for instance, there might be a big blip in crime. And then it would make sense that maybe you'd start moving more resources into that area if you looked at it and you were data driven. But if you lived in Baltimore and you knew that the date that the crime went up was the weekend of the Preakness and the crime was around the Preakness and the next weekend you weren't having another Preakness, if you simply follow the data, you would follow yourself down a wrong path. Do you think trying to bring some context to the data is important?
Yeah, absolutely. Data in itself is not going to give you answers. It can help give you answers, but you need human judgment. You need analysis, good analysis of the data, to build understanding and to use that to make your decision. It can't be just, well, the data says this, that's the trigger. You've got to look at the context, and you've got to have really good analysis of the data.
And what will be the follow-up to this conference? What are you looking to do next in terms of government reform?
I think procurement is an issue that we've started to take a look at, but over the coming months we're really going to ramp up, and you can look for a series of reports on how do we generate better value for our contracting dollars.
Thank you to our guests this week. I am a Teamster author, Terry Spencer Hesser, Economic Policy Institute economist, Heidi Shierholz, and Center for American Progress Director of Government Reform, Reese Rushing. And that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power.